For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey everyone, Dr. Jason Old here, surfer, historian, world traveler, and your host of the Surfing Historian Podcast. This season, we'll be diving deeper into the nuanced world of surfing and examining the historical, cultural, philosophical, and even scientific elements of the sport we're all stoked on. So let's paddle out together and ride through the world of academia. This episode is sponsored by Face Stuff. Face Stuff's an all-natural zinc-based product company from San Diego, California, that uses ingredients that are safe for the ocean while also protecting and moisturizing your skin. So instead of soaking up nasty radiation like chemical sunscreens, Face Stuff helps your skin reflect it. I'm a big fan of Face Stuff and always have a canister on hand and ready to use. Check them out at face-stuff.com and use promo code STOKED15 for 15% off their incredible products. Joining me today from Houston, Texas is Dr. Krista Comer. Krista is a professor of American Studies and Feminist Studies at Rice University in Houston. Her research centers around issues of place, contemporary cultural politics, the U.S. West, surfing as a global subculture, and critical race studies. She's been a visiting scholar at Monterey Tech in Mexico and at Stanford's Lane Center of the American West. She's also authored a number of books and essays on these topics. Among them, Landscapes of the New West, Surfer Girls in the New World Order, and she's got a forthcoming book she's titling Living West is Feminist, Conversations about the Where of Us. For today's episode, we'll be chatting about the origins of her book, Surfer Girls in the New World Order, which had to do with new ways surf culture was publicizing itself in the 1990s as girl-friendly. We'll also chat about the Institute for Women Surfers, an organization she co-founded in 2012, along with her reflections on the field of surf studies itself, as it's massively expanded globally in the last 10 plus years. We'll end the episode by getting some details about her forthcoming book, Living West is Feminist, Conversations about the Where of Us. I'm super stoked to have you on to share all this incredible information with our listeners. Krista's work in the field of surf feminism was really helpful in framing out a number of subchapters in my dissertation, so I'm really excited to get a chance to talk to you one-on-one about your research in this area. But before we get started, I want to personally thank you, Krista, as well as our listeners, for being part of this episode of The Surfing Historian.
Hey, Jason, thanks for having me. I'm really glad to be here with you and look forward to having this conversation.
Yeah, Krista, I'm super stoked to have you on. And, you know, as I've told you multiple times, you know, I really, really love the book, Surfer's Girl in the New World Order, and, you know, pretty much everything you write. But let's go ahead and get into that book. And, you know, just, I guess, first kind of out of the gates, what compelled you to write the book? And, I know, you know, part of it is, you know, talks about this idea of surf feminism. So what compelled you to write the book, and what is surf feminism for the listeners?
Oh, thanks for that question. Well, The term surf feminism actually was an achievement that came to be well after the book came out, that term. And at the beginning, that term wasn't even something I could imagine. And so the book came to me sort of out of being homesick, being away from home, being a long time in the Northeast, being educated. And, you know, I started to see, you know, I was pretty far away from the whole beach scene, the world of surfing, coastal life, living by that point in Houston, Texas, having been away from California for about 15 years. And I started, but I still tracked, you know, California trends. And I started to see this kind of general claim that surfing was girl friendly and that surfing, you know, there were these things called board shorts, and there were a lot of new pro women surfers who were young and feisty and surfing, you know, like Lane Beachley, surfing very big waves. And there was what I thought as somebody trained in feminist studies, but also as somebody who grew up around a lot of surfers and wasn't a big surfer myself, but was around it and traveled around with people surfing. And I thought, it's girl friendly, really? Okay, I want this to be true, you know? But the more I got into it, I really started to think about what surfing had become in the period since I really knew much about it, which is to say what surfing had become between like the early 80s and the late 90s, when surfing starts to retool itself and big business starts to arrive in more powerful forms, and the whole problem of environment is starting to dawn on people who are getting sick from bacteria, or who are also people who've gone to lots of places to surf, and they realize, you know, 10 or 15 years into it, that it's kind of a slum situation where you have a lot of Westerners out there and it's not so pretty. So people are getting nervous. So I was aware of this large change that had happened in the world of surfing. And I wanted to investigate more, and I knew some people in California. So I thought, oh, I'm going to check in with some of these people and start to ask some questions.
Yeah, no, it's a, you know, fascinating book. And it's really, you know, thank you, by the way, for sharing that. And, you know, you mentioned a couple, I think you mentioned Lane Beachley, but I want to talk about another female surfer that you, I think, kind of worked with in solidarity. And you mentioned her, of course, in the book, and that's Corey Schumacher. Uh-huh. And would you mind, I know that it's my understanding, you know, you give the story of her leaving Roxy to start a campaign that petitioning Roxy. I guess the campaign was Stop All Sex, No Surf.
Right.
But yeah, just, you know, can you give us a little bit of background on that and your work with her and this, sure, you know, this initiative?
So that initiative with that Corey Schumacher, it's her brainchild, and she forwarded it, and she knew how to forward that kind of thing because she was really an activist surfer, and she had a platform as a former three-time world champion longboarder. But the way I came to know Corey Schumacher was she read the book Surfer Girls in the New World Order, and she reached out to me about it. And when she did that, I was completely astonished. Like, I had been giving talks, but I didn't really always know about the book. I gave them in San Francisco. I gave them in different places. I gave one at Litquake, which is a local spot in San Francisco. Often it happens on the Great Highway, and it's a pretty cool place to give a talk, at the Beach Chalet there, next to, in the area where the Cliff House is. And so I would have these audiences. I wouldn't always know who was there. And the way I met Corey was, she was an audience that I never met personally, but she reached out to me. She wrote me an email and she said, hey, I've read this book and I'm really interested in what you have to say. And for her and from some other readers of the book, what they said to me, completely to my surprise, I wasn't expecting it at all, because was that book for them helped them diagnose the world that they were inside of, that they had been struggling to evaluate and stand up to and position themselves inside of. So that particular campaign that Corey did was a campaign. So one thing that she told me that I didn't realize after I published the piece you've just referred to about public scholarship and surfeminism is that she was not a Roxy writer, actually, but she did know people at Roxy and at Quiksilver. And she had been, of course, a sponsored writer, but she wasn't a Roxy girl per se. But she was tracking the ways that women were represented in social media. And this particular campaign was of Steph Gilmore. Like, she was such, at the time, I think she was 5 or 6-time world champion. And the video probably isn't out there anymore, but it was completely a soft porn shot of her, like, getting out of bed, taking a shower. It wasn't graphic completely, but you didn't quite know who it was until you didn't know what was going on. So it kind of brought you into the video world of, like, it was titillating. It was a soft porn titillation shot. And then, you know, she gets to the beach and you find out it's Steph Gilmore, and it's some kind of a launch for whatever year the world tour was that year, or I can't remember the exact campaign. But people were astonished that Roxy thought that this was a way to promote women's surfing, because there was no surfing by the world champion. There was just her romping around in her bed and then getting naked. You know, it's like, what in the world? How is this brand that's supposed to be the face of girl-friendly surfing? What kind of? And so Corey had begun these conversations with some of the Roxy, the executives at Roxy, and I joined her in those, and we went into the Roxy, which is where that particular essay opens, inside of that structure, which is, you know, super appealing. It's glamorous. It's, you know, high tech architecture. It's very, you can see why people go to these brands and they are really seduced. And those women who were working there basically wanted to say, hey, this is really empowered. These women are empowered. And Corey was saying, you know, I think we should have a different vision of what empowerment looks like. And the other thing she did was to collect a lot of signatures. That I think she got 10,000 signatures on this campaign. And it was quick and fast. And, you know, I hope at some point she does something with this document, because so many people signed onto it and made comments. And they said things like, hey, my granddaughter surfs. I really don't like to see these videos of no surf, sexualized female bodies as a way to promote women surfing. Like, hello, is anybody going to like give some action shots of women in surf? So, but I think one of the things to say about the term surf feminism, to come back to that, is that, so in the book, Surfer Girls in the New World Order, it's an early book that's trying to think about how to think about surfing. And there wasn't a book in the US that thought about surfing, period, from an academic standpoint. So there was books, like wonderful books by people like Matt Warshaw and a whole, you know, legion of writers and journalists who, and popular historians who'd been writing about surfing and basically chronicling the history of surfing since, you know, for the last 20, since Surfer Magazine was founded, basically. And you have this, you know, archive of the subculture produced by subculturalists who were also writers and photographers and the whole gamut of skills needed to basically take surfing global out of, you know, Southern California, the epicenter of the sport in the early 50s. And but there weren't any academic studies of surfing. There was Nick Ford and David Brown's book, Surfing and Social Theory. And that was recent, but there wasn't anything. And my way into it was through thinking about women and women's participation. So it is a book about women in surfing, but it was about thinking about the subculture and the business of surfing from a feminist political economy perspective. So not just thinking about women surfers, quote unquote, but thinking about the way that gender organizes the world of surfing everywhere, and that the images of women, which surf magazines largely produced in a pretty narrow way, to always be young, heterosexy, in bikinis and, you know, the famous reef ads, which are always kind of a G-string kind of shot of women, to do that over and over and over. So all of this profit basically accruing to a very select group of small group of men who are making all the money. And so that was part of what the book was about. And, you know, it interviewed women, it had an international dimension, and it did a lot of theorizing of how the and historicizing of how the movement developed from this kind of small scene in Malibu into this global subculture. So it really was a book about surfing and globalization that put girls at the center of it from a feminist perspective. And I think that's what, for somebody like Corey Schumacher, who's completely brilliant and a great organizer and was completely at that point self-educated, because she had spent all of her years that she would have gone to college otherwise on the pro tour. For her, she's just like, I mean, that kind of reading list that she had as her everyday reading, Corey's a philosopher and she likes certain kinds of high philosophy, basically. And she was already so literate that I was like, wow, I had no idea that kind of a reader was out there, you know? So I've digressed.
No, you're good. And, you know, and I think really, well, first of all, before I forget, I want to just mention to the listeners that your book is on our, you know, is on surfinghistorian.com. It's featured on the homepage, actually. But yeah, it's, you know, there's so much to say about that book. And as I've mentioned in the intro, it's really helped me. It helped guide a number of subchapters in my research and in my dissertation. And but, you know, I guess I have a couple questions about the book. It was published in 2010, you know, so that's
right,
pushing a decade and a half ago.
Exactly.
It almost seemed at the time, and I guess this is sort of a question for you, but almost seemed optimistic at the time. And maybe that's my limited understanding of really what was taking place as well as a surfer. But, you know, how have you seeing things change since you published that book, you know, in 2010, here we are in 2023. How have you seen things change and maybe hopefully perhaps for the better? And I guess the other thing I want to add to it is one of the things I know I took away from the book, and it at least made me think very critically about this. And then when I talk to my students, I sort of share this sort of image, if you will, is it's like you said about the advertising. You know, when we think about, you know, we crack open a surfer, you know, used to, let's say, a surfer magazine.
Right.
The male surfer is getting, you know, sitting deep in a barrel at Pipeline or Chopu or, you know, and it's a bathing suit advertisement, right? So it's Quiksilver or Billabong or whoever it may be.
Right.
Whereas on the female side, you know, it's a much different picture. It's, you know, just a woman paddling out or really much more objectifying of these female surfers. And so I guess that was a lot to say, you know, regarding the changes you've seen since the book has been published. And does that, have you seen women through these advertisements during this time become less objectified, or is it sort of much of the same?
Save big money now on new siding from LP Smart Side at Menards. Update and beautify your home with your choice of 13 timeless colors of pre-finished engineered siding. It's durable and includes a Sherwin-Williams factory finish paint warranty that means no painting for years to come. View our entire selection of siding from LP Smart Side today. And don't forget to check out our flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Well, I think that you asked me the right question, or the right, you have the right kind of observation about the book, that it has certain optimistic features. And it did come out in 2010, which means that it was in press in 2008, right? And so I do think all the structural interventions or observations that the book makes are completely still relevant about the way in which the gender dimensions of the global surf industry, the worries about what it means to take surfing to lots of places that have been open to business because of globalization, and then to quote unquote settle, or to use the term that you and I were talking about before we turn on the podcast, surf, settler, colonialism. Certainly those ways of doing business have intensified, I would say. So I think that the structural analysis that the book made from a feminist perspective about capitalism, about surfing, about the need for more green interventions and the problems with green capitalism, all of that stuff, those all remain really fundamentally relevant. What I was optimistic about and was the way in which women's relationships with one another could potentially serve as a platform for them to survive the sexism of surfing. And to some degree, I think that has been, that has held, that women's relationships with each other, to the degree they can diagnose what the problem is and not, you know, well, I could digress on that, but I think that has helped women generally. I think that the magazines and the whole surf culture, I think for sure women are still massively objectified in surfing. And, you know, the people who own, who gain from that, women can gain when they, you know, pose for things and get money for that. But as a kind of larger perspective, I think it's still a small group of men who basically exploit that symbolic economy to continue to create a sense of what the ideal surfer identity is, or what a kind of masculine profile is, and how I think that's all the same. And the fact that it's gotten more complicated, you know, so that there's more, like there's equal pay, for instance, on the pro tour, I don't want to overlook that. That's a major achievement. I think a number of the people that I know played a role in that. The big wave surfers, for sure, that have come to the Institute for Women Surfers and others. So that isn't something to turn your nose up at all. But I think the fact remains that, you know, that globally things are difficult. And women, it's not, women's consciousness is better sometimes, but the consciousness that really needs to shift is men's. And, you know, Andy Abel, is that his name? No. The guy who does the project in, I'll have to think of it and come back to, in Papua New Guinea, Stop Violence Against Women. One of the things that he said at one of the talks I gave in the last few years is that men need to step up. And it was after a talk I gave where he showed I can't remember the title of the video he made about Papua New Guinea violence against women and the way in which his surf projects have been taken on the violence against women as one of their core initiatives. But I think that that's right. Like the level of unconsciousness is just persists. And we live in very complicated times around issues of gender non-binary identities, gender fluidity, trans surfing, queer surfing, women surfing, equal pay, trans athletes. I mean, it's complicated for people whose job it is to kind of know about these things. And so I think that things have changed and there's more women in the water, but I think this might be a moment to talk about distinctions between notions of inclusivity and notions of justice, because I think that the projects that I feel most interested to support, that, and there's a lot of good projects out there by younger women and younger feminists. I'm thinking of Daughters of the Sea, which came out of the Institute for Women Surfers in Wales. And that's a wonderful project that basically puts a spotlight on cold water surfing and hashtag Rise Fierce. And some of the women who are part of that whole scene, those are hardcore feminists. Like they stand up against a lot of violence against women. Like you would be surprised the amount of drama. Well, I shouldn't put it that way. The amount of violence that happens in surf organizations. And like there's a, you know, they're the kind of conversations that we've had through the Institute for Women Surfers in places like Wales has been very eye-opening about the range of ways that things haven't changed or they still need to change. And you'll have to help me here. I've lost my train of thought.
No, you're good. I'm, like I said, I can't, congratulate you enough for, for this project and all the things you're doing with this. And I want to get more into the nonprofit or the organization as well that you co-founded. And just for the listeners, I also want to add that on our website, surfinghistorian.com, on the nonprofit page, we have, we've perused the planet to the best of our ability to add virtually every nonprofit, surf center nonprofit we could find. And we've divided it up by region, by country, and then the states by state, but also by mission. So empowerment, which includes, women of color, surf organizations, and a whole host of stuff. And so I just want to encourage people to check that out too. And, Krista, your work as well, obviously. I do want to, you said you want to kind of dive a little bit more into this, feminist work, feminist framework. But before we do, I want to read a quote from the book, or at least a quote I've pulled from your work. It says, "Feminist work and its long histories of creating alternative models of knowledge production can help surf studies scholars think through problems of democratic relations between the theoretical framework of the work researchers with community, not framing the work researchers with community knowledge creators." I think I kind of butchered that, but would you mind sort of explaining a bit more about this quote and elaborating on this for the listeners?
Thank you, Jason. And to the listeners, Jason is a very good host who rescues me in certain moments when, so to come back to what I was saying about making a distinction between inclusivity and justice, that was really the point about, and I'll get to this quote because it's also relevant to this kind of distinction. There's a lot of rhetoric out there in a million, online formats and Facebook pages. And there's just really, when I first in the Surfer Girls book started to work on documenting surf camps, it was documentable. Women surf camps, it was documentable at that point. I mean, you peruse the globe looking for all of these, there's so many now, it's really proliferated. And the mission statements that inclusivity matters, equal pay matters. It's naive to think it doesn't matter. It's anti-feminist to think it doesn't matter. It's anti-justice oriented to think it doesn't matter. But to include people as though we're including them in a state that's already trustworthy, that has everybody's best interests at heart, that's able to essentially adjudicate certain kinds of historic wrongs or distinctions on which the whole state is built, is wrong thinking. So justice work is different than being included in the state. Justice work focuses on certain kinds of oppressions, basically, and how they are activated in different contexts, whether it's the state or organizations or education. And the young younger women's organizations that I personally think are the most effective at helping women, to come back to your point or your earlier query, is those organizations that, I mean, there's a lot of organizations out there that do things like help women trade. There's a Facebook page, Women Who Surf, I think is the name of it, that's headed by Vanessa Yeager, whom I like very much. And she does Latinx surf also, I think. And it helps women trade tips about how to surf and where to go and products, and it helps them promote services. But it's a private Facebook page now with 30,000 followers. So that we're in a different moment than the moment earlier, like 15, 20 years ago, where it was such a novelty to have a Facebook page for women, a private Facebook page where people could talk about surf issues as women or as gender diverse people. And I think that the inclusivity frame allows a certain kind of discussion, but the kinds of things I think that are more social justice oriented are really going to need to happen in smaller contexts. So, for instance, what I was just talking about, the Welsh organization Daughters of the Sea, or Tara Ruttenberg, who I know you've had on the show, who's quite a, I think she's a very clear thinker about decolonial surf tourism, about decolonizing tourism, about, you know, Central American gender relations and gender politics. She's a very, her thinking is pristine and yeah, very good on these topics. And she runs something called Tarantula Surf.
Yeah, exactly.
And there's another group called seatogether.com or .org, but it's by Brianna Ortega, who, it's also a kind of small group of people, and it does have the language of inclusivity, but it's behind a kind of justice framework. And so these are not the same kinds of initiatives. They have a different politics to them that are like extremely large and, you know, pro-business tent, I would say, and some other kind of philosophy that's going to be able, and smaller group that's going to be able to do the work of basically directing traffic about the complexity of all these issues. You have to have some clearer thinking to be able to sort out all the various kinds of challenges women face in the world of surfing. So that is, I'm trying to lean into your question about, which is, the quote comes out of this article, Surf Feminism, Critical Regionalism, and Public Scholarship. And it's an article I wrote having already, the book comes out in 2010, and then I have like 5 or 6 years of doing the Institute for Women Surfers in a pretty dedicated way, which is this public humanities organization dedicated to education and feminist education that's small, that's relational, that is dedicated to issues of justice, that's trying to think about a difference between women's equality and women's liberation. All of these things we could, you know, if we were talking for a couple of weeks, we could unpack all of this.
Absolutely. Yeah. And by the way, just, you know, you mentioned, first of all, Tara was very helpful. Just a little shout out to her, of course, helpful framing that for me, that concept of surf settler colonialism. And I know there's others that have written about it, but yeah, Tara's work was very helpful with that. But kind of back to your, what you were just talking about, the Institute for Women Surfers, you know, you mentioned Brown Girls Surf, and I have here, I've just pulled up, you know, my surfinghistorian.com, right, and we've got, you know, Babes on Waves, Bitches and Barrels, you know, Brown Girls Surf, Black Girls Surf. So there's a whole host of these what seem to be women empowerment organizations. And I know, like I said, you mentioned, you know, in the article that we're talking about now, you mentioned Brown Girl Surf and some other organizations. But yeah, absolutely. You know, I would love, and I'm sure the listeners would too, love to hear more about, you know, these organizations and really what lies at the heart of this Institute for Women Surfers.
So first of all, on the phrase settler surf colonialism or surf settler colonialism, and Tara Ruttenberg, I know Tara has been working in this area for a while, but this is a concept that I directly want to credit to Dina Julia Whitaker, who showed up at the Institute for Women Surfers as an Indigenous woman, surfer, feminist, scholar, and really began to help all of us understand the links between settler colonialism and specifically masculine settler colonialism.
Yeah, exactly.
And surf territorialism. So I know that Tara gave a talk that year. So there's a lot of different organizations, of which you've just named a number of them. And to bring it back to the quote you were thinking about, us talking about feminist work and its histories of creating alternative models of knowledge can help surf studies scholars think through the problems of our own democratic relations in the theoretical work we do as researchers with community knowledge creators. So for me, I have learned so much from people like Surf Sisters, Black Girls Surf, Brown Girls Surf, women of color surfers, and their enormous generosity, and Corey Schumacher, and Dina Julia Whitaker, who is Colville. She's from the Colville Federated Tribes, but raised in LA. And what that kind of vernacular or community engaged expertise brings to scholarship is critical for us to make sure that we, for instance, don't colonize the work that we're privy to when our quote unquote informants talk to us informally. If they talk to us informally and we don't figure out a way to write explicitly about they've given us these ideas, not just like context, but concepts, which are supposedly the province of scholars, like that, we get a lot of that, at least in my work as feminist work, as deliberately engaged research. I'm getting that from them. And I consider one of my acts of accountability to all of those people who are helping me to make sure that I name them and support them. And as I am trying to do on this podcast, make explicit reference to where I get my knowledge, because otherwise I really do think we run the risk of running off. Like I, in that particular essay, talking about like we need some theoretical humility, because we could go every place and start talking about everything because we have research accounts and lots of different kinds of skills. And then we publish books that the people there never read. And that to me is not a kind of principled research ethic.
Well, yeah, Krista, you know, I couldn't agree more. And, you know, you even kind of, I think you posed the question in that article. But, well, first of all, I think the Surfers Girl book and the Institute for Women Surfers really embodies this collaboration between, we'll say, scholars and activists, which is, I think, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, sort of a question that you pose in that article. And so I do, it does seem at times we sort of wall ourselves off and write these books and articles that only, you know, sort of preaching to the choir, so to speak. And really, you know, just to kind of put a plug in for the podcast itself, you know, having you on, having many, many others, the goal is really to make this information accessible to people who might not have those, you know, accounts to get into academic journals or whatever. And so it's really, you know, pushing it out there. But I guess, you know, we've sort of been talking about it, but maybe you have a clearer response to this question. But how can scholars and activists, you know, more broadly collaborate? Because it does feel like a lot of times they work independent of one another, when I think we make great teammates. I mean, what are your thoughts?
Right. So I agree with you that the podcast is an opportunity to do a kind of, to have conversations that bring different constituencies in the world of surfing into some moment of talking to one another. When you look at a lot of classic surfing get-togethers, a lot of them over decades have been this kind of mix of industry people, journalists, surfboard makers, pro surfers, celebrity surfers, and people who write about surfing, right? And I think in many ways, that's a great model for how And I've gone to many conferences like that in New Zealand, in Australia, in Santa Cruz, in San Diego. I think those are really valuable occasions for those kind of conversations to take place. I have to say, when I've gone to those conversations, those kinds of events as well, depending on who organizes them, you see all of the strains or the tensions in the surf world active. You know, you see who seems to have the media that, you know, like get the most promotion. I remember one conference I went to when I was actually a visiting scholar at Stanford. So I felt fairly decently credentialed at that moment, you know, and I just like felt like, well, I asked one of the women later, I said, what was going on? She goes, man, that was a bro out. And like, that's how it felt to me. Like, I felt really out of place. And I was like, whoa, am I just like, I don't know. It was just really, so the tensions that exist in surfing and surf organizations are real. And I want to say a couple of other things about that. One of them is that when we think about surf organizations, I mean, we're talking about like globally, things like Surfing England, Surf Scotland, these kind of big words, Surfing Wales. I remember one year at the Institute for Women Surfers going to one of our Welsh trainings, and some of the Welsh men got wind of what we were doing, and they were so misogynistic on open Facebook pages. They talked about me particularly as being old and ugly. They talked about, I mean, all this stuff, you know, and it was like, because we were having this meeting of the Institute for Women Surfers, like we weren't even calling anybody out, or we weren't even pissed off yet, you know? I mean, so it was quite interesting to see those tensions. And there's different ones in Surfing England. There's, you know, like who's at the top of Surfrider. I don't have any truck with Chad Nelson. I think he does a great job, but like who's in leadership in all these organizations, and to what degree are they including women? They incorporate feminist decolonial perspectives. That is a justice perspective, right? So I think it's not a small thing to think about how to have collaborators across, you know, like the Global Wave Initiative or Surfrider or, you know, the Conservation Conservancy or Sierra Club, or because all of these are now linked players, to have people who know how to do, you know, engineering work or all of the kinds of remediation work that's going to need to happen at places like steamers in Santa Cruz so that the break doesn't drown, right? Because of sea level rise. So it's really kind of a task to think about how people can, and then to have business interests, like whoever's made the most sustainable new surfboard, for instance, or the best new app platform. Those are also the kind of people that get airtime at a place like that. So coming back to scholars, I think that we need to be in those environments, and we need to have skills to speak to those environments. And when I've been in them, I'm often aware that I need to develop new skills. And I'm like, well, let me try just to figure that out in addition to my day job, right? Which, you know how it is in the day job of a professor, it's demanding. And I think the fact that we write for one another, it's not our fault. It's the contradiction that we inherit by being in academia. I mean, that's the whole promotion structure. That's what academic presses recruit in your manuscripts. That's what you're supposed to do. And so I think methodologically, we really have to be clear about what methodologically we see ourselves doing. Do we see ourselves doing projects that engage vernacular expertise? And if we do, what are the frameworks? This is why I'm making a lot of points about feminist frameworks, among others. They do allow you to make the case that this will help you do the work of creating a different world. It will help you do the work of climate justice. It will help you do all of this other stuff. So for me personally, I take that. You and I have had sort of the conversation about the Institute for Women Surfers it's an organization, but it's not like an institutional entity. It's an us. It's a relational project. And I think for all of our work together that we need to prioritize. This is me speaking for the stuff that I want to do and that I will be a part of now going forward. For me, I see feminism as a relation as much as a perspective or an argument. I mean, I can make a lot of feminist arguments, but I see it as a relation. And especially with other women, aware of myself as a white feminist, I think that biggest commitment is to keep these relationships going and keep them alive. And to do that, you need to care more about the relationship than you care about a particular project or your idea. And that is, for me anyway, one of the ways I'm trying to think about going forward, legacies that I hope are part of the work I've done. There's a great essay by Bernice Johnson Reagan. It's called Coalition Politics, and I've been reading it because of this new book I'm doing. I've been rereading it. It came out in 1984. And she talks about why people do coalitional work. And they do coalitional work, which is collaborative work, because they need to, because they have to, right? They have to do it for mutual survival, not because they want to necessarily, because it's really hard and people don't get needs met, needs in quotations. That's not where you go for a sense of home. That's what she says. You don't go to your coalition for a sense of reassurance. You go there to figure out how to fight a shared perspective. And so that's what I've been trying to do in the Institute for Women Surfers, is to establish whatever we as a group might consider a shared perspective, and then figure out how we're going to go after fighting on its behalf and making clear that we care about our relations more than any particular project or product. Because if we don't have the ability to keep talking to each other, we don't have the ability to keep fighting.
Save big money at Menards. Let the fresh air in and keep the bugs out with replacement screen for your doors and windows from AdForce. It's easy to install, durable against the elements, and comes in a variety of types to suit your needs. Repair your screens today with a roll of replacement screen on sale through May 5th. And check out more great deals happening now in our weekly flyer on Menards.com.
Save big money at Menards.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, one of the things I know you had sent me just in kind of leading up to the podcast, it was in talking about your organization. I think you said it's not it's an us, you know, and I think right. you just reiterated that. And that's, you know, I think the relationship building or the relationship element of it is, you know, should be at its core. So I think, you know, I commend you again for this effort. And, you know, as you were talking about some of these events around the world, you know, I'm thinking about the Global Wave Conference of 2020, which, you know, I know you weren't there, wish I would have met you back then. It was over.
It was in Australia,
Right as COVID was ramping up, or, you know, on that, in that side of the planet. But, you know, one of the things that struck me there that was this wide array of people. You know, we had the Surf Rider, we had Save the Waves, who are doing, you know, they are doing incredible work around the planet.
Oh, yeah.
But we also had, sort of representing that surf feminism element was Rebecca Olive. And, you know, I just remember her presentation and some of her graphics, and I was like, okay, you know. But then we had some nonprofits that were advocating about more sustainable ways of doing surf and surf products. And so, you know, I thought I really enjoyed that. And it really opened my eyes to this world that I think we can all participate in making it more equitable, a place that's more welcoming for women and other, you know, other groups that aren't necessarily historically welcomed into this hyper masculine, hyper white masculine surf culture. Right. And so, you know, your efforts and others, you know, like I said, that's why I, you know, proudly put these on the website, because I want to create a resource for people to get involved. And so, you know, so again, you know, I just want to commend you for that. And, I do, you started to allude to it a little bit. So I think this is the perfect opportunity to segue into your new book project.
And so,
would you mind a bit of a teaser for myself, maybe selfishly, but also for the listeners? Tell us about it. What's this new project all about?
This new project comes out of many years of knowing people who are working as scholars on the U.S. West, which is one of my areas of interest. And I've written a lot about the U.S. West. And so I know a lot of feminist scholars who work on the U.S. West and therefore put the concept of place someplace central in their work. And so notwithstanding that fact, what I noticed anecdotally over the years is when you have conversations with people about their relation to place, it's slippery. Like, what is my relationship to place? And what is my relationship to place as a feminist? And so this project puts that question at the center of what we're trying to figure out as a group. And it's another, for me, it's like the Institute for Women Surfers. And I learned from the Institute for Women Surfers and people like Dina and Indigenous Relationality as a kind of framework and methodology. So as a group, how do we see this question? And one of the ways I wanted to take up methodologically the research was to go to a place that people love and to have the interviews in that place. So my husband, whose name is Jose Aranda, is Chicano Studies Scholar here at Rice, and I drove last summer and the summer before about 15,000 miles all over the place, talking to people at a place of their choice about their relations to place and to feminism. We talked to, and I have a blog. You can look at it, feministwest.rice.edu, I think is the website address. And it's about to come out as a book. I'm in the final stages of revision, but it's about relationality. It's about feminism as a relation, and it's about our relationships to place, which is, you know, one of the things I always loved about surfing and that I talk about in the surf book is the way in which place is central to people's sense of what they're about, their identity, even if that place is linked to other places. So you have a home break, but it's linked to whatever other breaks that mean something to you, and that then also mean something in the world of surfing historically. And so this book is going to be an interesting book, because the other thing I've asked people to do, you'll appreciate this, Jason, in the context of our conversation, is to speak about themselves as younger feminists. Like, what were they like when they were 14 or 16? And I think as scholars, we get trained away from talking about ourselves as before we became all the way educated or became. And, you know, I take my lead from people like Sarah Ackman, the feminist Killjoy blog, but also from people like Cliff Evers, whose work I admire very much. And he talks about in Notes to a Young Surfer, how he came into consciousness as a young surfer who understands himself to be part of a masculine settler presence and a lot of surf breaks. And he was one of Rebecca Olive's advisors. And Rebecca, you can see how much, I mean, Rebecca's work in Australia and New Zealand, she's such a team player. Her work on ecofeminism is so out available in so many ways. She really goes to bat. And you know what she won't say that much publicly is how much heat she takes for that. Actually, it's not cool. You have no idea some of the stuff that happens to some of us and that has happened to me in various kinds of Institute for Women Surfers contexts. I mean, it's really threatening, actually. But she's, you know, she really goes to bat, and she's extremely mindful of working with her collaborators. You know, I can't say enough positive about her. And also, while we're talking about people who've been collaboratively just brilliant and generous, Lisa Hunter, who's at the University of Frankston in Melbourne. I think that's right. I probably don't have that quite right. But anyway, they've written a lot on surfing, gender, sex, sexualities. And also in the Welsh context, Lindsay Studley, who's a PhD student who finished at Cardiff in geography, who studied the Global Wave Initiative, and the activist Danny Robertson from Surf Senoritas. She's just hardcore, like she goes to bat for people. So yeah, there's a lot of good people out there, and I take heart in our relations with one another. I do think that we've just seen in the US a Supreme Court decision that just came down 10 minutes before we began about, you know, discontinuing affirmative action. I live in Texas, you live in Florida, like there's a complete assault here on DEI initiatives. We're talking about inclusion and inclusion, not even its justice. And in Texas, you know, DEI is now needs to be scrubbed from universities that aren't, I'm at Rice University, it's private, but I think it all comes back to bring it around to, and also talking about living West as feminists, to us as scholars, talking more about ourselves and being skilled at being able to not abstract ourselves from the work, because that is the work of disassociating from the knowledge that we actually are producing and not being accountable to our authority. So I think the feminist act is to not disassociate.
Yeah, you know, and you, first of all, you know, obviously, you know, shout out to Rebecca, as you said, she's doing amazing stuff. And I'm pretty sure she still has her podcast going. So
yeah,
by all means, you know, all of those who are listening around the world to this, please go check that out. She's doing incredible stuff, as you know, all the other individuals that, you know, Krista, you mentioned, like, by all means, you know, to the listeners, there's some amazing work taking place around the world in these areas. So, and you know, one of the things you said about she and others taking heat, you know, as I feel, you know, like I'm somewhat of an advocate as well, you know, albeit as a male, but I've taken heat as well. And I'm not trying to put myself on par with you guys in that arena, but even advocating for the things you all are advocating for, you know, some of the more machista individuals push back, you know, and I that pales in comparison to what I'm sure you've dealt with, what Rebecca's dealt with, and those of you who are, let's say, on the front lines, if you will. And you know, one of the other things I wanted to sort of come back to that you mentioned was, you mentioned sort of like a teenage feminist, for example, you know, the pre-academic, if you will. Right. And I honestly, my research and all the things that I've written, including my dissertation, which I'll hope to be converting into a book, I would not have been able to write what I wrote had I not drawn from all my experience sort of pre-PhD, pre-grad school, all of that. And so absolutely, we have to, at least I would say I agree with you. We need to lean into all of that. But yeah. And so, you know, Krista, thanks for obviously filling in our listeners and myself with this new project. I'm looking forward to reading that book like I, you know, read, you know, Surfer Girls. But with that, I want to go ahead and give you the last word. And I guess obviously you can share whatever you want for the last word, but maybe where you see the fields of feminist studies or even surf studies moving forward. But with that, Krista, again, thanks for joining, and you have the last word.
So thanks for the invitation for last words. I really appreciate the conversation we've been having about male allies and your sense that, you take some heat too when you stand up for certain things. And I think that there's a lot to say about what male allies and men can do in their work with other men to interrupt sexism. And I've had a number of experiences over the last 5 or 6 years. I mean, I spoke with the one earlier with our Papua New Guinea friends and the film Splinters, that is really a brutal documentation of violence against women in Papua New Guinea. And him stepping up to the podium after I gave my talk to say, hey, guys, you need to step up. And I myself, it's hard to do all this work. I didn't think to do that, but he modeled for me what was appropriate. And I think it's easier for guys to do that with other guys, actually, but it's not inappropriate for women to do that and feminists. And so at the end of that San Diego State University conference in 2019, I guess, or around there, what I decided to do was to ask the audience during the wrap-up session we were having, how many men there would be willing to be part of an initiative of male allies. And I could see it made people nervous, but I kind of decided I was going to go for broke because we had a great conference and I felt that the moment was right. And so I put certain people kind of on the spot and I said, okay, I'm going to come ask for your signature. I'm going to come ask for yours. And, but one person, so I never was able to have the time to follow that up, but you encouraged me to think it's possible to follow it up. And I will say that Dan Reinemann at UC Cal State Channel Islands followed up and he wanted to do a survey with me. And we were supposed to present that at the Global Wave Conference in Australia, but I did register to go, but I couldn't go at the last minute. And we didn't quite finish that, but I have an idea for the Surfers. I took a web domain in this Surf Allies Initiative, I think I called it. I'm still paying for it. I should finally do it. But I think that there's a lot of room for men to make themselves aware of what women face all the time in life, but in the lineup and, you know, in surf geographies and in the parking lot and in surf stores and the whole gamut of things, and to be willing to talk to other men about it, just like I think white people should talk to each other about white racism. So I think some of the final thoughts I have is when I make a point about saying that I focus on women often in surfing, but my focus is as a feminist doing feminist analysis. And I really would want for scholars, now this is for scholars, to not think of work on women as not somehow also about political economy. And, you know, I've had different conversations with different people about that and they've been good, but it's really just unaware to think of work that's talking about labor or globalization that focuses on women isn't also focusing on empire. Of course it is. It's just training that we have to think that women are this side category. They're not about the world. And a feminist analysis is not about the world. So that's another way people could ally the work of feminism. And then finally, you know, I mean, I've had people reach out to me who are unexpected, like one of the guys from New Zealand, Ed Atkin, reached out to me. And we've had interesting conversations about, like, what to do when guys are assholes. That's one of his queries to me. I said, well, first of all, they're not just being assholes. They're engaging in a power struggle with you. And we shouldn't understand their behavior as bad behavior. We should understand it as oppressive behavior that's a power dynamic. And they're dominating. They're trying to dominate you through that dynamic. That's different than saying the guy's a jerk. That's not the same kind of analysis. It's helpful to put it into a kind of more power-driven analysis. And, you know, I think just the very final thoughts are the people who, you know, I've done a lot of work with. I'm thinking of Elizabeth Pepin Silva, the photographer and the filmmaker, and also my dear, dear friend, Sol, who did the wonderful film, It Ain't Pretty. Those people have kept me company along the way. And I do think that our relationships are what can help us figure these things out and sustain us. And, you know, once again, Jason, just really grateful you had me on the podcast.
If you enjoyed my conversation with Krista about her research on surf feminism, I'd like to invite you to check out my next episode, where I'll be joined by journalist and novelist Michael Scott Moore. Michael and I will be chatting about a book he wrote on surfing that he titled Sweetness and Blood, How Surfing Spread from Hawaii and California to the Rest of the World, with some unexpected results. We'll also be talking about the memoir he wrote after being kidnapped in early 2012 on a reporting trip to Somalia. That book's titled The Desert and the Sea, 977 Days Captive on the Somali Pirate Coast. If these stories seem intriguing to you, then this will most certainly be an episode you won't want to miss. We also want to take a moment to thank Face Stuff again for sponsoring this episode. Don't forget to check them out at face-stuff.com. And while you're there, use promo code STOKED15 for 15% off your purchase. Thanks for joining us for another episode of The Surfing Historian. If you're stoked on these conversations, be sure to share, like, and subscribe to never miss an episode. And don't forget to check out our killer merch at surfinghistorian.com. Proceeds go to help keep this amazing podcast going strong. Until next time, stay stoked.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Save big money now on new siding from LP Smart Side at Menards. Update and beautify your home with your choice of 13 timeless colors of pre-finished engineered siding. It's durable and includes a Sherwin-Williams factory finish paint warranty that means no painting for years to come. View our entire selection of siding from LP Smart Side today. And don't forget to check out our flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at
Menards. Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.